So I only had one option at that point, and that was to jump in the river and swim across. And, so it's about, I guess I jumped, I don't know, down to the river was probably about 12, 15 metres and then about 40 metres across.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Distance Cycle Podcast. I am your host, Matthew, and today is a show with a difference. The difference is that you could be watching this on YouTube. Here I am, and this is the first ever YouTube episode for the Distance Hiker Podcast. I'm going to be trying to put more and more of these episodes on to YouTube as time goes on, if guests are comfortable doing so, and we'll see how it goes. So, moving on to today's guest, I have got the wonderful, the gentleman, that is Chris Howard, known also to many of you as Chris the Coast Walker. Now, Chris the Coast Walker made headlines in the news a couple of weeks ago for having finished his walk around the coastline of the United Kingdom. 11,000 miles or thereabouts were walked over the course of, I think, a year and a half or so by Chris, which includes lockdowns and all of the challenges that were presented to him due to COVID, as in addition to the ordinary challenges that he'd get and expect when walking such a distance. Chris came onto my radar some time ago when I first set up the group, and he's been a really active member of the UK long distance hiking community, so I just had to have him on and talk about his experience of him finishing his route. And Chris was just an amazing guest. I thought he would be, and he just totally was. He blew it out of the park. He was just so honest and open and transparent about his experience of walking the coastline. And he shared so much with us, and more than he needed to. And that's exactly the kind of guest I love having on the show, somebody who's really honest and easy to talk to and just wants to tell me everything, which Chris just did. So there's tons of nuggets of gold in this particular episode, and just a really sincere and honest, genuine story about somebody's dream to walk there, or dream, I don't know if Chris actually dreamt of this, but his plan and the action he took on that plan to walk around the coastline of Britain. So my ramblings on aside, without further ado, I very excitedly welcome and introduce you to Chris the Coast Walker for episode 15 of the Distance Hiker Podcast. Enjoy.
Fitting into the kids' new routine and stuff like that, and just trying to adjust back to family life, really.
How's the adjusting going then? Obviously it's pretty different to be back to, I want to say the word normal, I think that undermines what you've been doing, but back to this average reality of life with just doing family things and kids and school pickups and drop-offs. How are you finding it?
I mean, I'm loving the pickups and drop-offs and being around the kids and my wife and stuff, yeah. But it's everyone else that is the problem, and like everything else that's going on, because
what do you mean
people
by that?
Don't really understand, and people just sort of expect you to go straight back to work,
sure, and
be what they want you to be,
yeah,
or what they expect you to be. It's a kind of weird thing, and people look at you differently, and you notice how kind of judgmental people can be because you're not straight back at work and stuff like that.
Is that something you're finding being the case in everyday life with like people you know already, or more
absolutely, okay. Family, friends, and then there's the side of it where you've got lots of people that want to catch up with you because they haven't seen you for such a long time and they want to hear all about it, which is great, and then you've got all those people that you expected that from but you haven't heard from, and it's kind of a strange situation to be in.
So is that, so are there friends that you've sort of lost contact with through this then, through that sort of absence?
Yeah, I feel like that. They'll have their reasons, I guess, and yeah. and it's fine. And I know a couple of them have genuinely, deliberately stayed away and have messaged me to say, you know, it's still probably pretty intense for you, so we'll just give you a bit of breathing space, sure. and then we'll get in touch when you're ready.
That's nice.
But a lot of people have just sort of just kind of washed their hands of it and don't want to know.
Has that been something you really struggled with, or have you been generally okay with that? And is that a pint of Guinness you got there?
Yeah, sorry.
It's fine.
It's something that I craved.
That's awesome.
Passed away.
That's great. I do have on my notes, grab a glass of wine or something nice to drink when doing a podcast. So you're the first person who's done that. So that's made me very happy. I've got a glass of water that I can talk
properly. Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, we've just been not long back from swimming and stuff like that. So
nice.
Just had dinner and my wife poured a glass of wine and I thought,
why not?
Let's go down the tree.
Why not? Of course. Yeah. So how has it been seeing your kids again? Because, you know, I'm guessing you could count the days that you've seen them over the last couple of years, really. How is it
getting pretty back much to on, being on
dad again?
I mean, it's great. It's like always a little bit kind of awkward and you're a bit nervous of each other at first, you know, and you're sort of feeling each other out for the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden the daddy questions come and did you know this, and guess what, and it hasn't stopped being like that since, really. And
awesome.
it's lovely because it's just, you know, there's always going to be something that bonds us. And I've been to park run with them every week.
Nice.
Been out to the park yesterday with them as well.
Yeah.
Just doing everything I can with them. I planted a tree at their school this week, really lovely.
Yeah.
And just doing everything I can with them, really.
Brilliant. The reason I wanted to talk to you was because you've been a huge personality on the page, like on the Facebook group. You know, you've been busy, I guess, with other groups, but for us, it's I've really enjoyed the updates, and quite frankly, I've been selfish about this. I was actually gutted when you finished. I was like, I've not followed anybody in terms of coast walkers and people doing these kinds of things in the same way I followed you. Like, I followed you quite intensely and just really enjoyed the blog post, the updates. And I don't think I'm alone with that. But what has, I think, passed me by, probably me less so, because I remember what we spoke about last year, I remember quite a bit of it actually, but I know other people perhaps might not know the full story from start to finish. So I wanted to try and capture that story of like the seed of an idea to sort of the finishing, really, in this kind of space that we've got. So in sort of, you know, 40 minutes or so to an hour. So I was hoping that'd be all right with you. Now, could you quickly just give us a quick overview of who you were before this and what you did?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, that's really kind and touching of you to say.
You're welcome.
thank you. Before, I was a builder, dad of three, obviously. A happy kind of husband and guy, except I had been diagnosed with depression not long before the pandemic, actually. Things were pretty tough, but we were a pretty happy family.
Yeah.
And I remember, and it's interesting because I've just literally written about this in the first or the second chapter of the book about the walk.
Okay.
And then it all stemmed from this one day in the period where we had that amazing weather. And I was stood in the back doorway looking out into our garden. My kids were running around in the garden in the sun, playing with the hose and spraying water at each other and stuff like that. And then my wife was like kneading fresh bread dough on the side. And, you know, I had this moment of kind of weird clarity. Like, I could smell that dough and I could see the kids running around in the garden and playing, and I just couldn't think of a more perfect moment in my life. And the odd thing about that is that at that moment I chose to turn to my wife and say, so I think I'm going to go for a bit of a walk. And it was all because I was watching my children being so happy and loved and just in an environment that was amazing.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't stop thinking about children out there in the UK that were suffering and had it worse, a lot worse off than them. So yeah, I wanted to do something for children specifically, and I decided that I would go for a bit of a walk, and I decided on the coast, and it snowballed pretty quickly from my wife kneading the dough to sitting around the dinner table and having a full-on conversation about it.
Yeah,
that didn't really stop.
Okay. Okay, and then from the point of having that conversation to actually making the decision to start and go, how many weeks was that?
I think it was about 3 weeks.
Wow, okay. And did you do much? Because obviously you can't prepare for what you did in 3 weeks as much as maybe some would want to prepare. Did you do any preparation? Yeah.
Well, that was exactly the thing. I mean, I started on the second day. Like, I haven't had that conversation. The following day, I was like, right, this is what I've got to do. I've got to prioritize. I've got to get a list of things. I've got to get a website. I've got to get a Facebook page. I've got to get an Instagram thing because I don't know how to use any of that.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
So I was like, I've got to do all of that, and then maybe I'll get some attention. I've got to contact the charity. You've got to do all that admin side.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, physical and mental preparation, I've always been pretty active and fit, but obviously we were right in the midst of a lockdown and everybody put on a few extra pounds and they were eating too many cakes and drinking too many beers. So I was the same.
Of course.
But my wife made this amazing point. It was, you know, this is a trip. This is a distance that requires a lot of time and thinking and thought.
Yeah.
And you could spend a year trying to plan it, or you could go and get on with it and see what happens.
Okay.
And once you've gone, you've gone.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the theory. So my planning and my actual preparation, it essentially involved me packing my backpack and unpacking it and packing it again about 100 to 150 right. times to kind of whittle down to the sort of base level of what I could take with me. And then it was a case of telling people, like friends and family, and saying, right, as soon as the restrictions are lifted, this is the date, I'm leaving from here. See you. Whenever, and that was it,
and
kind of just built momentum as I went, really.
Yeah. And did you then when you were doing this packing and trying to get ready for the event? Oh, we're actually going live now. Sorry, I just figured out we weren't live. Now we are. Hello, everybody. from the point of packing, from the point of having the idea, it was 3 weeks. You gone on the trail. When you started doing this. And you stepped, you know, from the starting point, which was
Heacham South Beach.
Heacham South Beach in Norfolk. Did you have any moment at that point where, how were you feeling at that point? Were you just thinking, oh, what have I done? Was it a feeling of excitement and elation? Where were you? Where was your mind at that point?
Yeah, that was a tough one because we'd spent a couple of days there with the kids and some friends and some family getting ready to go and thinking about last minute things.
Yeah.
I even did a Facebook Live from there to a load of children,
nice.
Just so that they knew I was going on the journey and stuff like that. And it was good. On the day I left, my bag was packed, you know, I was ready to go.
Yeah.
We all sat down to the beach and everybody was waving me off. And
was that
my brother-in-law,
quite a big group of friends and family then who were there?
Yeah, it must have been, I don't know, 20, 30 people. So it's fairly decent. And in fact, the campsite we stayed on, a load of the people from the campsite and the owners of the campsite came down as well, which was really lovely.
Yeah.
And there was someone from the BBC there, and it was just like, oh, wow, this makes it pretty real sort of thing.
Yeah.
And my brother-in-law joined me for the first few days, which was great because I had that kind of company. And we set off, and I sort of gave my kids a hug and say goodbye to my wife, and I turned to walk down the beach towards Hunstanton, and sort of every few minutes my brother-in-law kept turning around and waving, and he'd say to me, oh, they're still there. I'd say, yeah, okay. But I didn't turn around, and because I'd kind of made a rule with myself that once I was gone, I was gone, and I didn't want to, because if I turned around I felt like maybe I'd have to run back just quit straight away. So I just went at it, and I think we ended up doing 28 miles that first day.
Wow.
And it was really hot and pretty tough going. And
what time of year was that?
So that was the end of July.
End of July, okay. Yeah, midst of summer then.
Yeah, really, really quite warm. Yeah. And it got warmer and warmer.
And how did you How did you find it initially? So the first kind of couple of weeks or months of doing the walk, because this was
the first
this
day,
was pre-pandemic as well, wasn't it? Or was it?
So this was at the end of the first lockdown.
I
found it probably physically tougher than I did mentally on the first day, and then for the first few weeks, because I was being quite hard on myself in terms of the distances, and the heat wasn't really helping.
Sure.
And also, I wasn't really telling people what I was doing. Yeah. I was just trying to get miles under my belt and kind of get my head into what I was doing. And at the end of the first day, I actually really hurt my knee, which it was an existing injury, but I thought it was good enough and I thought it had healed enough to not worry about.
Mm.
And then I just misstepped at the end of that first day. And I remember that night in my tent, literally crying, thinking, I don't want to call this off. I don't want to quit. So I just stubbornly.
Was that a pride thing at that point, or just that you just wanted to complete
it? I think it was definitely a pride thing. I didn't want to be. Not that I didn't want to be seen to quit. I've never given up anything in my life, and I didn't want to quit this, like, at that first hurdle. So I told my brother-in-law in the night, and when we sit up in there, he said, just take some painkillers, chug some water, see what's like in the morning. Sure enough, I packed my gear up in the morning, and it was just agony. So for about 3 weeks then, I was necking painkillers, and I ended up buying a strap for my knee.
Oh, okay.
And I remember getting as far as Margate in North Kent. And I literally, just as I was coming in or onto that beach, my whole leg seized up and just, I couldn't bend my knee at all. Right. And I walked in almost like, if you can imagine, like a stick man, just sort of waddling in.
How did you overcome that? Because surely a lot of people, probably including myself at that point, would go, this is not feeling like a good idea. Maybe I should return home for some rest and then join the trail again. How did you carry on with that?
Yeah, so it was at that point I spoke to some friends, well, some family, actually, just a handful of people, and said, look, this has happened. I'm pretty worried about it, but I think it'll be okay. Mm. I just need to ride it out. And they all said the same thing. You've got to go and speak to a doctor.
Yeah.
But I knew in my heart of hearts, if I did that, that the doctor would just say, well, you've got to stop walking.
Yeah, of course. Obvious advice to give for a general practitioner, just to go home. You know,
So I didn't want that. So still being the stubborn sort of guy I am, I decided that I would switch my boots out for something flatter and thinner soled. So I went for a barefoot style boot, which were quite flexible and lightweight.
Yeah.
And I switched them for the boots I had been wearing, which were quite supportive. But they're great boots. It's just they had a kind of supportive heel, which I think that was throwing my leg out of alignment a bit. So I switched them out, and then every night in my tent, I strapped my leg to my backpack to sort of stabilize it in the night.
Okay.
Because if you can imagine, when you lie on your back, your legs do one of two things. They either do that or they do that.
Yeah.
It's just a natural thing. So even my feet doing that was putting pressure on the ligament in my knee, and it was just making it agony. So I strapped my leg to my backpack every night, and after about 3 weeks of doing that and kind of started to do stretching exercises and little build-up exercises, and having switched my boots out, the pain had gone. And in fact, my knee was getting stronger and I was getting more confident. I took my strap off. I kept my strap with me, but it just seemed to work. And I didn't take any more, the reason I chose to do that is because I was taking handfuls of painkillers every day, and I couldn't sustain that. I thought that was probably going to be worse for me and my body internally.
Was this constant stream of ibuprofen and paracetamol and things like that then?
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I knew that would have an effect on my kidneys ultimately. So I just thought, enough's enough. I got to stop. And I hadn't. And after that, I didn't take a single painkiller for the rest of the journey until I got home.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And even now, I haven't taken painkillers.
Would you put that down to, I don't want to go too much into the barefoot thing, but I know you have talked about it a little bit anyway. I also wear barefoot predominantly.
Yeah.
Would you put that down to wearing barefoot shoes or a number of things?
I think a number of things.
Yeah.
I think the barefoot shoes probably have a big impact. I think that it definitely helped. When you look at the science of how a foot is formed and how it works or should work.
Sure.
And then in terms of the stretching that I did and bits of yoga and stuff like that to try and strengthen my knees and just small acts of self-discipline by keeping my legs and feet straight and doing the right thing at the right time. And then also reducing some of my mileage on alternate days just to ease up on the leg a little bit every now and again.
Yeah.
So things like that. And also giving myself a different kind of focus by not pushing myself to do 30 miles every day and trying to enjoy it, I just became happier. So I was noticing the pain less, and you know.
Sure. And trivial question here. In terms of what you took with you in this, you know, within the first couple of weeks, couple of months of this walk, what didn't make the cut? What did you bring along which was entirely unnecessary, and after a little while you thought, I don't need this, it's going in the package home, or it's going to a charity shop or whatever?
I mean, I sent a jumper home pretty quickly. It was way too hot for a jumper. So I think in the end, in that first bit of summer, I had two t-shirts, a pair of base layer bottoms, a pair of shorts and a waterproof jacket. That's basically all I had, and a beanie hat, and then and a cap, because it was so hot. Things that didn't end up making the grade. I don't know if you've seen the little, they're like almost plasticky material or rubber material water bottles that just collapse right down.
Oh yeah, I know, the soft flasks or whatever they're called.
Yeah, exactly, like a soft flask. So I had one of those on that clipped to my backpack.
Oh yeah,
right on the strap. Mm-hmm. And I also had a reservoir, you know, like a Camelback reservoir type thing. Both of those went within a few weeks.
Yeah.
Just got rid of them completely.
It's heavy, aren't they?
Yeah, and just annoying. They're sloshing around in your back. Mm. You know, the water gets warm. It's like pointless.
Yeah.
So those went. I decided to remove my spare gas canister because I was headed to the southeast, which was heavily populated. So it was going to be easy to replenish it.
Yeah.
So there's no point in carrying more.
Yeah.
I went down from 5 days of rations to 3 days of rations and then 2 days of rations, which I knew I'd have to increase when I got to remote areas, but I knew in built-up areas it was pointless carrying more.
Yeah.
What else? Yeah, all sorts of... Oh, I ditched my high wind whistle because my backpack clip had one on it, so there's no point in having a spare.
Sure.
I had... What did I do? I was given a new head torch. There was nothing wrong with my head torch. It was just slightly older than the one that I was given.
Hmm.
And it had a rechargeable battery cell in it. Yeah. So I didn't need to then carry stocks of batteries.
Okay.
What else? I think, I did pretty well with my initial packing. And, you know, I wasn't overly worried. I think I left with about 13 kilo base weight.
That's pretty good going, really.
It's pretty good going. And that, you know, that's with water and food. So
I was under the impression you might have had a slightly bigger base weight than that, because obviously you are carrying enough to keep you sustained for fairly long periods of time.
Yeah, although that was my summer base weight.
And then the winter one, I guess, was a bit bigger.
It was a bit bigger. And then by the time I got home, I was upwards of 25 kilos, because people giving me things left, right and centre, and I was, you know, getting t-shirts from pubs or restaurants.
Oh, I see.
Different hats and different things. Yeah. And you just like end up laden with this stuff because you feel impolite by saying, no, I don't want to take it with me.
Burdened by the generosity of strangers.
But also winter kit is so much heavier, you know.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. Yeah. Even the lightest weight stuff and a good quality waterproof and all of that, it does weigh you down, I'm sure. So.
So waterproof trousers I stopped wearing before I even got out of Wales.
Yeah.
And then I didn't put them on again.
I listened to the podcast you did with Owen from Hiker, and I heard that shit. Yeah. And walking poles as well is something you don't use now.
I mean, I think they're probably very useful, but I've just never walked with them, and I didn't see the point in having them. And it got to a point, everybody was saying to me, oh, you should have poles, you should have poles, you should have poles, everywhere I went. But it got to a point where I was, you know, I'd come all the way around the west coast of Scotland, and I was now headed towards John O'Groats, and I thought, well, I've only got to go down the East Coast now, so there's no point in me getting a pair of poles.
Yeah, of course. Stage. Yeah, if you didn't need them at that point, then why are you going to need them down the rest of the East Coast? So.
Yeah, and ultimately, it's kind of cooler, isn't it, to say, I want the whole coast of Britain without poles.
And worst comes to worst, you find a stick and
exactly.
have a staff and look great with that.
Look so, like Gandalf. I mean, exactly. I've got the beard.
Or do the whole, look like a pilgrim, which is, okay, so that's cool. I just wanted to, one more question. This is just logistical stuff that I'm just generally interested in. Tent. What did you use as your tent for this as well?
Well, I had a mixture. So I had a tent and a bivy bag, which pushed my base weight up slightly, I know. Yeah. But I used my bivy bag as my dry line sack inside my bag. So I always had the option of using it if I wanted, but it also just kept everything dry.
Yeah.
And my tent was a Terra Nova Laser Compact 2.
Okay.
So it's just over a kilo, I think.
Yeah.
It's a great tent. It's an Integral fly sheet. It's perfect. I absolutely love that tent. And then, solid guys.
Cool. All right. So I just want to get into the time scale of the walk as well. So you started in July. So did you say June or July?
July 2020.
Okay. And you finished last month.
That's right. But I have to take off 4.5 months of lockdown in Wales.
Okay. Yeah. So lockdown in Wales, did you say?
I was locked down. I got to Wales the day they issued their lockdown statement and I managed to get out of Wales.
Yeah,
like literally just before they went into lockdown, so I had to get on the last train.
Yeah, and you then went home for a bit, didn't you? For that period.
That's right. Yeah, so I feel like it was I don't know if it was the right decision or the wrong decision, but if I'd have carried on walking, I'd have been breaking the law effectively.
Do you regret not carrying on walking at that point?
I kind of do because I was never really in contact with anyone, and at that period in time, most people were just indoors. I would have got around the whole of Wales, not a problem. But at the same time, what I was doing was for raising money for charity. Obviously, I didn't want to bring the charity into any kind of bad light, and I certainly didn't want to do anything wrong or get into any trouble. So I decided, going home would be the best thing. And if I hadn't, I wouldn't have seen my kids or my wife at Christmas, and I wouldn't have seen them for a long time. Mm. So I just tried to carry on fundraising from home, and I did little events, and I did lots of talks and things like that.
Mm. That must have been, though, a difficult decision to do, because by that point, surely you would have been well and truly into the flow of walking, and then to suddenly have to stop, go home, lose all that momentum, perhaps lose the fitness a bit that you gained on the trail, and then sort of rev that back up when you got back on the trail. How did you find that period?
Absolutely. And
as somebody who, as you said at the beginning, you struggled with depression in the past. Was that something that crept back at that point for you, or
did
you?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay? Got to a bit of a low point, and not just mentally, but I mean, physically, I'd adapted really well on eating very bland and very few calories every day, really. Yeah. And to the point when I got home and it was near Christmas, and over that Christmas period, I was really ill and I couldn't take calories on and I couldn't keep food on board because my body wasn't used to all those rich things. I couldn't eat meat because it just came straight back out.
Ill was because of the new, just having a regular, Western diet again, opposed to your trail diet.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so I really struggled with that for quite a while. It was really wasteful Christmas, to be honest, because I just couldn't eat anything. It was really bad. But the mental side of it was a struggle because we all thought maybe I'll be here for 2 or 3 weeks and then it'll be okay. I can go back to Wales and we'll carry on walking. And then week rolled on to another week and then another week and then it was another month and then it was another month. And I just sat back in that situation watching those daily briefings and these figures going up and up and thinking, that's it, it's all over. Like, I'm not, I don't know. And then the fundraising just sort of went and dropped right off.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I've raised these funds on the basis of what I was doing and I'm not going to be able to complete.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. How did that leave you feeling then? If you did you feel like a failure at that point, perhaps?
Pretty, I mean, I didn't. I knew in my head that whatever happened, I would eventually get back out there. But my worry was that any of the following that I'd amassed, or anybody that was kind of interested in what I was doing and that had donated or helped in some way, would just think, well, that's it. Like, he hasn't done it. He's not good at it. He hasn't committed enough or whatever. And I just felt that's what I thought. That was more external, that the kind of judgment. I felt like there was an external judgment rather than that, it being built up by myself. Sort of thing.
But I guess that is that same fear of judgment that might have stopped you in the first place from carrying on. Obviously, at that point, there was a lot of social media shaming for anybody breaking lockdown rules.
Exactly.
So I would guess that had an impact on you choosing to come off the trail anyway for fear of, you know, comments and.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. And there were even points where before that lockdown, I was allowed to be where I was and I was allowed to be doing what I was doing. And I would get comments from people if I went into a shop or if I went to get new supplies or whatever. They'd say, are you on holiday? And I say, not really. I'm walking around the coast of Britain. And they're like, you should be at home. You shouldn't be here. We don't want you. And you just think, okay.
Yeah, so. And it's hard to address that as well, because obviously you're trying, you want to portray a particular image, not obviously arguing with audience members in your comments section on Facebook. Never goes well.
Yeah, ultimately, I never want to come across as rude or judgmental myself. I'm always kind of kind and curious first, and I try to think that if you put that out into the world, that's what you'll get back. But But also, even when I have received anything negative, and I've received far worse than that on the trip round, but even when I have received stuff, I've tried to sort of smile about it and be positive, and I've never kind of bitten back or tried to retaliate because I'm not wired that way. I don't think that solves anything or is good for anyone. So,
Okay, that's super interesting. So eventually you got back on the trail 4 months or so afterwards and lockdown ended. What was that, April, May?
Was the 12th of April,
12th of April, cool. So you picked up again in Wales. And you if I recall from observation, you actually made progress really quickly. You seemed to steam ahead. What kind of daily mileage did you kind of get up to? What were you doing generally on average in terms of daily mileage?
Yeah, that was an amazing time. So I went straight back to Aberystwyth. My brother-in-law, who started with me, had 3.5 weeks off work and came with me. And he was like, I know I did 3 days before, but I want to give this a proper go now. It's amazing. I want to do it. So we just smashed the hell out of it. I mean, and we had this period of like glorious hot weather. It was April in Wales. We didn't have a day of rain, and it was incredible. So I got from Aberystwyth all the way up to Chester, I think, in about 5 weeks, and that included the whole of Anglesey and the whole of the Lynn Peninsula and Snowdonia.
And you got up Snowdon,
and it was just well, that was the worst weather day. It was Snowdon, so we decided to summit on the only day it snowed, and it. We got to the summit and it was -9 degrees with the wind of about 45.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the video of you up there.
Yeah. And I had like icicles in my moustache and all sorts. This is crazy. But we still summited because I'd said to my brother-in-law and a friend that had joined us, I said, it's not so dangerous that we can't summit. But the reality is I have to summit today because if I don't, then it pushes everything back and I won't be able to get where I need to go.
Yeah. And I guess that was a sideline to the walk as well. So prepared to cut it loose, I guess, if you need it. But did you summit all of the three peaks as you went up as well?
Yeah. Nice. That's right. Cool. And Snowdon was the worst weather.
I bet. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me. So you did some stints then with, you know, family, your brother-in-law, for instance. When they left you, did you enjoy that solitude again, or did you feel that you missed that company?
Yeah, it's really strange because as much as you love the company when it's there and you really kind of relish it, because it's just nice to have someone to engage with and share some of these, not just incredible views, but share the actual magic of the trail and the path that is, you know, I always say to people that come out and walk with me, I'd refer to the path as she, and I would say she gives and she gives and she gives. She never takes anything from you. You know, she's always giving you a new opportunity to learn something, whether that's you falling on your ass or whether that's you looking at a new flower or some wildlife. She's always giving. And nobody understood it. They just thought I was going mad because I spent too much time on my own. But eventually my brother-in-law, after a few weeks, he kind of got it, because we went through this woodland and all of a sudden I heard silence, complete silence, because he stopped walking behind me. And I thought, what's he done? So I turned around immediately and he was just looking up at these trees, and you could just hear this gentle creaking, and he'd never heard it. But it was just the boughs of the trees gently swaying in the wind, and you could just hear this creak. And he said, I would never ever have noticed that if I was at home, and I've never heard it before. And it's just amazing to feel that connected and in tune with something natural. And I was like, yeah, I know, this is how I live every day. It's great.
So was that something that you developed on the trail, or was that something you already had inside of you, this kind of
I developed it on the way around, because right in the beginning, you know, even things like estuaries and inlets and diversions, that's what I saw them as. I thought, that's a diversion for me to go 200 meters, but it's a 20-mile round trip. And I was like, God, that's such a diversion. And I came to the thought that that's a really negative way to look at it. So actually just look at it that the path has given you a new opportunity to see something, and that's just part of the journey. And actually just switching and shifting that mindset to seeing it as a positive made me kind of fall more and more in love with what I was doing. And just, and I guess that's why I referred to her as she, because I kind of like personalized the path to me in a way. And that's how it went from that point on. And and I do think that most people that came and walked with me, when they heard me say things like, oh, she gives, they just used to think I was mad. But but I loved it, and I loved being alone. But equally, as much as I loved having people there, as soon as they went, it was like I could breathe again, and it was a sigh of relief, because it was just me and her, you know, me and the path. As human beings, we are by nature quite social, and I think we all, no matter how much we love our own company and fall in love with the path and whatever, I think we need other human company. I think we need that socialization and ability to be around other people. So I definitely did miss it, but I embraced the isolation and the loneliness as well as best as I could, just to kind of see how I would react to it and how I could make a positive from it, and kind of grow from it as well. The longest I was alone for in Scotland, right in the northwest, I was on my own for 23 days, and I didn't see a single person, and I felt pretty disconnected. And
Is that disconnected in a bad way overall, or were you generally okay and comfortable with that?
I was comfortable with the fact that I wasn't just surviving, but I was actually kind of thriving on what I was doing and enjoying that. But it's interesting, because I recently had a conversation, like literally earlier today, had a conversation about that. And I said, the thing that I couldn't get out of my head during that time was that I'd left a world in pandemic, and all of a sudden, and even though I was in a remote area or an isolated part of Scotland, I had been seeing people on and off. Then all of a sudden, for 23 days straight, I was thinking, am I the only one left? Like, what's happened? Has everybody just died from this COVID thing and it's got worse and I didn't know about it, or what? And that was a really strange feeling, you know, like a kind of weird 28 days later sort of scenario.
Must have been a relief then to sort of, 20 or so days later, just peer back in civilization and think, fuck, everybody's here and everyone's all right still.
It was really strange, because I saw a family with a dog on a beach, and in my head I was like jumping for joy and like thinking, quick, go and speak to them. But I was also thinking, you can't act weird because you'll scare them away. Like, and it's, it was a really strange, like, conflict in my head.
Did you speak to them?
I did, yeah. And they were really friendly and really kind. Yeah. And they gave me some fruit and some sandwiches as well. It was lovely. And they'd hired like a little lodge up the hill, and they were staying there for a holiday or whatever. And they said there was a village just up the road and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they were really friendly.
Perfect. That's a great link to what I was going to ask you next. So what struck me as a viewer of an observer of your walk was the repeated acts of random kindness by strangers.
Mm.
Was that a daily occurrence for you where people would just give? In addition to the trail giving, was that something else that added to that richness of the experience, that people would freely just give and offer you rooms and, you know, fruit and food and kindness? Yeah,
I wouldn't say it was daily, but I mean, I was genuinely surprised at how much kindness I received. And it was honestly, and I know it sounds cheesy and corny, but it was genuinely life affirming to think that there is still a part of humanity that is kind and caring and willing to give without anything, you know. And a lot of the time people would assume that I was homeless, and they did, and that, but most of the time that was fine as well, and they still wanted to give, and it was incredible. And the things that I did get given, it just blew me away. It wasn't always
like
just
what,
the case
for example?
Of like, well, it, you know, it wasn't always the case that someone would just give me, I don't know, a bottle of water, but I had people pulling up to me along the side of a promenade or in an area where there was like the beach and then some rocks and then a road, they would pull up and they'd be like, haven't got much to give you, but we've got some coconut water in our boot and some nuts. Do you want them? Like, okay, thank you very much. But having no idea who I was. And then other things, like when I got to Durness, having had a really tough time in Cape Wrath, a woman had messaged my wife because she couldn't get hold of me because I had no signal. Until I literally got a mile from Durness. And she said, oh, we've got some shepherd huts. Would Chris like to stay in one for a day or two and get clean and wash his kit and have a proper rest? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that'd be lovely, thanks. And I was expecting, you know, like a horse-drawn kind of cart with just like a wooden platform, almost like a boffy. Yeah. This thing,
which in itself would have been nice anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially because of a massive storm, I got there and this thing was like palatial, like full on double bed with the best mattress you could imagine, great big pillows and duvets. It had radiators. It was all like tiled kitchen surface. It had a full on kitchen and a dining table. It had a TV that swung around on the wall. It had a bathroom and a shower. And it was just like, wow. So I was able to, strip off all my gear and get it clean and hang it all up to dry. And even just my tent and my jacket to get them dry was a bonus, you know. That was just amazing.
Because that particular bit was on the back of the hardest bit of walking you did, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
There was a bit of an incident at Cape Wrath with getting wet and having to use those survival skills, am I correct?
Yeah, I feel like Cape Wrath wasn't one incident. I feel like it was a series of incidents that, well, Cape Wrath became the incident, you know, like the whole thing was
an incident. Give us an overview of that and what that looked like, because it's known for being a very remote and difficult bit of walking with no clearly marked trails
sort. It's just so isolated.
Did it in the winter as well, didn't you?
Yeah, winter. I had a contingency that I would stay at the lighthouse at Cape Wrath because they have a bunkhouse that is allegedly open all year round. And that was my contingency if anything went wrong or if the weather was bad or whatever. Unfortunately, when I got there, the weather did turn and it was full on whiteout. Really bad storm coming in. And bizarrely, the bunkhouse and the cafe there were closed. And they're all boarded up and locked. And I thought, I couldn't find anyone around. So then I had another 13 or 14 odd miles to walk, I think, before I could get to somewhere relatively safe.
Yeah.
But that became quite tricky in the conditions and on the terrain. I fell into a peat bog with a dead sheep that had come up next to me as I was trying to figure a way out. And I was then like trying to scramble out of this peat bog by pushing down on this floating dead sheep, and it stunk as well. And then So then I'm sopping wet, and then it was now about
dead sheep.
60, 70 mile an hour winds or something. And my GPS kept failing because I realized I was going around in circles for a bit, because there's a natural phenomenon there with the type of geology affects the compass readings and the satellite. So I couldn't get a true bearing. I had to just sort of fix a bearing on the horizon, which was literally about 20 meters in front of me. And just relied on very, very basic navigation skills in order to avoid falling off the cliffs. And then get around and get over this hilltop, which is, it's quite mountainous there as well. It's like an amazing place, really. But so then I managed to remember, I found these two streams, which I'd remembered from looking at the map previously, and I'd kind of committed to memory that area. And I managed to handrail these streams all the way down to a river, which was in full spate, and then had to follow along that river, where I knew on the opposite side there was an old shepherd's hut. And I'd earmarked that shepherd's hut, thinking, in worst case scenario, if I'm in that area, I know it's there, and I should be able to find it, sort of thing. And I did eventually find it, but I had about 30 minutes of light left, and there was no way I was going to get all the way around the river and back down without either breaking my leg, without getting full hypothermia, because at this point I was actually shivering pretty uncontrollably. So I was faced with the decision. I could go as far up the river as I could, where I knew there was a wire bridge with a couple of planks, which I'd been told about. However, that had been washed away because of the rain and the storms and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was no good to me. So I had to go further up the river, and it kind of snaked around, and there was a bit of a chicane in the river. And I figured that if I could jump into the river or jump across the river there, where the water slackens in the bend, I should be able to swim across. And that way, if I could swim hard enough, I would hit the other bend and then be able to get out of the river. And if I didn't do that, I would have ended up hitting the rocks and probably not having a great time, maybe not coming out at all. So I only had one option at that point, and that was to jump in the river and swim across. And so it's about, I guess I jumped, I don't know, down to the river was probably about 12, 15 meters, and then about 40 meters across.
40 meters?
Yeah, it was pretty wide.
Wow, that's a pretty big river crossing.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm thinking like, relatively narrow river. We're talking pretty substantial, fast-moving river.
Yeah, I mean millions of liters of water per minute.
Oh, that's pretty scary stuff then.
At that point.
Yeah. So what was going through your mind? Were you just in survival mode there, or were you thinking clearly, like, this is what I need to do to get to this across
this
river?
The whole day through, things were going from kind of bad to worse, and then much, much worse. So the whole time I was sort of scenario planning and thinking about what were my priorities, what did I need to do, what was I going to do next, how would I get here, blah, blah, blah. And I had to try and just keep calm and keep focused on the end point, which is try and find that shepherd's hut and get there. Because if I could get there, even if I couldn't make a fire, I'd get dry. And I'd be able to just be sheltered, sort of thing. So, at the moment, when I made the decision to jump in, I probably danced around the idea for a few minutes thinking, oh, well, if I just walk another few miles, but in my head I'm thinking, you can't walk a few more miles, because if you do, it will be dark. You'll fall in the river anyway, and you don't want to be in the river in the dark. So I was like, right, okay, I've either got to commit or I stand out here all night and freeze.
So you jumped in the river, got across.
Jumped in the river with my backpack on. Swam as hard as I could, which is, it's hard to swim with a fully laden backpack on at the best of time. I don't know if you've ever, it's like a really abnormal turtle.
I can't claim to have tried it, but it sounds.
I wouldn't recommend it, to be honest, Matthew.
No, to be honest, I wasn't planning on really having a go at this. I mean, I like a bit of swimming outside, but with backpack is not really on my radar.
Yeah.
But you got across. How did you then get to safety? How did you then get warm and dry?
Yeah, so I managed to heave myself out and I lay on my back for like what felt like forever, just looking up. But I pulled myself up and got moving quite quickly, and I made it within what felt like a few minutes, really, because I just was moving as quick as I could to try and stop my core temperature plummeting. I mean, there was water in my pockets. I was having to empty my pockets as I was walking. I was squeezing out my gloves and
I
could see the light fading, but I could see the boffy or the shepherd's hut up ahead. So I managed to get there, and I just threw my bag inside. There's no electric or anything, obviously, but there was a fireplace, and there was a few like scrubs of old heather which were dried and which would have been good for kindling. But there was no hard fuel like logs or anything like that. So I ran outside with my head torch. There was a peat shed behind the hut, so I grabbed a couple of chunks of peat, and then I found some bits of old timber which I think were from a bench or something that had been outside previously, and I brought those in, and then I filled this massive drum of water up from inside the boffy in the river, so I had fresh water inside, and I just stripped off all my clothes, hung them up, and then so I'm like, so at that point I put my jet boil on to make coffee because I thought I need to get hot liquid in me and I need to be dry. So I'm there in the middle of this dark thing. I've hung my head torch above on the ceiling so that I've almost acting like a light bulb. I'm jumping up and down naked waiting for this coffee to boil whilst trying to saw up these logs and then construct a fire in the fireplace that's not going to be dripped on by my wet gear. And then I sorted the gear out of my bag. I put food on the side ready to be cooked. I got fresh, dry base layers out of my dry bag, pulled them on, pulled my dry beanie hat on, put fresh, warm or dry socks on. And then I started making the fire. So I used the heather as the kindling, and then I'd split down a few feather sticks and stuff like that from the logs and the bits of wood from the bench. And then in the other room of the boffy, I found a load of old, like, cladding, like wooden cladding that hadn't been used. So I just started hacking away at that and making chunks out of it. And I just constructed this fire. And then I think it probably took me about half an hour to construct the fire and get all the materials ready for it.
Yeah.
But just doing that, I knew would keep me warm just by doing it, because I was, you know, getting my heart rate up and stuff. And then I necked this coffee and I got some noodles on the jet boil going straight away. And I couldn't stop thinking about my wife and my children, because I was just like, that could have been, I mean, that was serious, but that could have gone a completely different way. And I've got no way of contacting them. And I just had to sit there all night thinking about it and not being able to contact them or contact anyone. And it was just,
it's
pretty grim. But I mean, I managed to do all the right things. And in the end, I just settled with the fact that I couldn't have done it any differently. So,
Where did the knowledge to do that come from?
Because
you went through quite a series of very, of survival steps that and some very like sensible judgments that not everybody would be able to make. I'm not even sure I don't think I would have made all those right decisions that you did. I probably would have bailed at the river crossing point. where did that come from, that knowledge? Is that something you had before or something you gained on the trail?
I think a bit of both. I mean, as I say, I've always been pretty outdoorsy and I've done lots of other things. And I was a scout when I was a kid. But aside of that, I think it's the fact that being out on the trail for so long at that point and having gone through so much, but I'd simplified my life. My thoughts every day were on a survival basis. It was like literally, walk, eat, sleep, walk, eat, sleep, walk, eat, sleep. Live, and that was it. I think we all worry about making the right decisions, like for that judgment reason we were talking about earlier, and normal life takes the simplicity of making decisions away from us. We've got to think about so many other external factors, whereas in that situation, my choice was simple because it was do this or die. You know, there is no other option. The other option is far, far worse. So it was a case of you have to act. And I think it's just that sort of sheer will to survive, I suppose. And that's just what it came down to on that day.
That's amazing. It's quite the story. That would you say that would be? That's, I mean, that sounds like a real pinnacle moment then for the walk. Obviously, surely it doesn't get much scarier than that. I'm just taking that in because you described it so vividly there that that was obviously quite a terrifying moment. Did you at that point when you were just in the bathroom and you were just, you know, drying down, and I'm assuming the adrenaline was just sort of rushing out of you at that point, you were coming down from that. Did you doubt what you were doing then? Did you think, right, I'm still making the right decision, I'm glad I'm doing this? Or did you think, I just want to go home right now?
It's kind of interesting because when you let a negative thought creep in, that's when you start doing something wrong. And what I knew straight away, even though I was freezing cold, the first thing after drinking the coffee was I took on another litre of freezing cold water, which is counterintuitive to what most people want to do because, you know, you're still almost shivering, you're still freezing cold. But if you don't take that water on, you're probably going to be very dehydrated through the night. Your body's not going to work efficiently and it's not going to get up to the temperature it needs to. So I did that because I knew I had to. But I did sit there after I'd eaten, after I'd taken on water and after I'd had coffee and after I'd got into dry clothes. I did sit and chew it over for the whole night, really. And I sort of thought, could I have done that better? Could I have done this instead? What would have happened if? And I assessed it and I just kept thinking over every last inch of it. And at the end of the night, before I went to sleep, I decided I made all the right decisions at the time because I'm here and I can't think about this anymore because if I do, I could go on for weeks or months thinking about what ifs. But the reality is I'm okay and there shouldn't be anything worse than this from now on. So, because that was my last truly isolated point. And that was a big turning point for me was Cape Wrath because I knew from there I'm effectively headed along the top of the coast.
You're walking home.
And then coming home,
Yeah, great. That must have felt great, the feeling that, right, I'm walking home. Or as you, let's go to that actually. So you obviously, you finished Cape Wrath, you sort of got to the, quite a high point in Scotland, and you kind of turned the corner, started going down the other side of the coastline. Obviously, there's some remote sections there, but increasingly you hit some Scottish cities. A lot of built up area as you come out of Scotland, you know, down Northumberland coastline into, you know, Newcastle and Sunderland, Newcastle, etc. Were you sort of, did you have that haste on to get home at that point? Or did you think, okay, I'm nearly kind of, I'm quite close, so I can maybe slow it down a bit. What were you feeling in terms of that last kind of stretch of,
it's dangerous to want to slow it down. And I absolutely could have slowed it down much, much more. But I did the top of Scotland in like 9 to 10 days. I think it was just that quick. And then coming down the east coast of Scotland, it felt like it was disappearing for me. And then northeast of England, I'd never really been to that area. So I loved Newcastle. I thought it was great. I met some people there that had been following me and they put me up and they were just amazing, amazingly kind people. And I actually have got a postcard to send them this week. I completely forgot. I've been sort of doing that as adjustment, just to remember people and say thank you and send postcards off to them. So I sending theirs this week. And so that was really cool. And then, down to sort of, all of that Northumberland coast, like Bamborough, just amazing. And then sort of people started engaging with me like on a real human level again. And that was quite nice. But I did find it a struggle being in built up areas and in cities again at first. because it was just, it was strange because in cities and big towns, people tend to sort of avoid eye contact with you. And anything that's different, they just kind of have, the, you know, city syndrome, I call it, and they just eyes down and ignore anything different. And it's all the sounds that are really strange because I wasn't used to them. So everything sounded really, really loud. And the smells of things are totally different as well, you know. But yeah, cities are dirty, loud, horrible places. but yeah, I didn't really have it in my head that I've got to get a stomp on to get home. I had worked out that if I was going at a particular rate, which I was, I would get home on X date. And I thought, well, okay, I'll say that. I will make that an event. I will tell people that's where I'm coming home because I knew I'd get there by then unless something severe happened, like I fell off a cliff.
How far ahead were you able to set that date?
I think about 5 weeks, something like that.
Where were you at that point? You must have been quite well attuned to how far you were going to get in a certain...
Yeah, I think I was somewhere before Hull, something like that.
Oh, okay.
Because I know at some point we were going to try and meet up on the Lincolnshire coast, and then
we were
disappeared.
I was working that day, I was gutted. I know. Yeah, you were just shot by. It's like, okay.
It was amazing.
But I mean, it was flat walking as
it's
well.
So
I mean,
flat.
Must have just at that point for you, that must have felt really easy.
Yeah, absolutely. And then obviously to top it all off, once I got back to Heacham, I decided to walk from there back to Cambridge, my hometown, partly for publicity and raising extra money for the charity, but also my brother and brother-in-law wanted to come out and walk with me. My brother's getting married in May, so he wanted to have like a bit of a stag do, which was he's going to walk with me from Cambridge to from Kingsland to Cambridge. And that's totally flat as well, but it's quite a nice walk, to be honest.
Okay. And then the last little bit obviously was, you know, walking inland from Heacham to Cambridge. And did that for you count as part of the walk, or was it just sort of an extended walk?
Just an extended walk home, really. Although when I got to Bridge Street on Cambridge, the reason I did it is because I finished the walk at Heacham, which is the beginning of the River Great Ouse, which goes into the Wash.
Okay.
And that river becomes the Cam and ends on Bridge Street in Cambridge. And I row on that river regularly. So it was like, oh, that'd be a quite nice finishing touch, you know, to end there on Bridge Street. And that's what we did. But so when I got to Bridge Street and I met Pudsey and a crowd of people that I was just bowled over by, I clocked 11,087 miles. So I decided to run the Cambridge Half Marathon the following day with my backpack so that I could bring it up to 11,100 miles, because the 87 would just annoy me forever.
Fair enough. That half marathon must have felt like a breeze for you at that point.
Yeah, it was a breeze, but it was also lovely because my brother-in-law again joined me for that. So it was nice. Yeah. And it was just a really lovely sunny day as well. And there was 15,000 people, and I think every single one of them patted me on the back or said well done and how amazing it was, and stop and walk with me for a minute and chat. And that was great, you know.
Yeah. Oh, remarkable! Yeah, that must have felt weird, though, being, you know, the center of all that interest as well, because you're a humble guy, you know, and I think this is why people are drawn to you, and you've done, you know, if you met your fundraising targets, for example, because you're not full of it. How did you handle that, you know, that celebration at the arrival, you know, the kids who are waiting for you, the Pudsey Bears, all of that. How did that feel when you walked into Cambridge to that crowd, that audience that's just there?
Honestly,
for you?
It was so alien and strange, and I sort of like, I knew there was a few people there, but not that many. And I had my GoPro on my shoulder, and I was doing a live thinking that there might be 5 or 6 members of my family and maybe a handful of friends.
Yeah.
And as I came around the corner with my phone, I think I probably ended up forgetting to end the live and putting my phone in my pocket or something, because I just couldn't.
Yeah.
I couldn't comprehend what was going on. You know, there were just so many people, like a good few hundred people there, and I couldn't say hello to everyone. And even though, like, I was recognizing faces in the crowds and wanting to say hello to everyone and say thank you for coming, I couldn't, because I was almost pretty speechless, and I just couldn't understand that there were that many people willing to come out and sort of welcome me home. It was it was pretty emotional, and but more than anything, I was just shocked.
And do you miss it now you're home and you're settled? I guess you're settled or settling back in. Do you miss it?
Yeah, I miss.
That was quite a big, yeah. Is it quite a strong feeling you have about not being on the trail? Because it was your home, you know, walking and the coast.
It becomes part of you, you know.
Sea was your home.
It's,
Yeah,
absolutely, I miss it. And any opportunity to get out for a proper extended walk now. And it's because of the simplicity. You know, all of this, you know, you can see how cluttered my bookshelf is behind me, for example. Like,
you're not seeing after right to right right now.
But imagine that as a model for our lives. Like, that's how busy life gets, you know. But out there, it's just simple. You know, walk, don't walk. Eat, don't eat. Drink, don't drink. That's it. There's no bills or worries or wars or pandemics or depression or people judging you. It's just you and the path and swimming in the sea or the loch, and it's how life should be.
And have you managed to take any of that simplicity that you've learned out on the trail and try and put it into your routine at home?
I'm calmer at home. I'm much more.
Yeah,
I've always been pretty patient as a person, but I try to be a lot more patient with things that perhaps I wouldn't be patient with. So, and I'm much more mindful of not just my surroundings, but the people around me, and that said, that's not always a positive thing. That can be a negative. You know, I start to notice little inflections in the way people look at you or like say things in particular. There's little things that you pick up on that I didn't pick up on before. But generally, I feel quite proud of the fact that I've done what I've done. And I'm also proud of the fact that it won't be the be all and end all. It will be something that will come back with me, and I'll do other things because of it. I've been given some really good opportunities because of it. Like planting this tree for the Woodland Trust this week was amazing, and I plan to do a few more things like that. I'm doing some amazing talks for different organisations, including UK Scouts and various schools. And a few other organisations. Actually, I've got a talk at Cambridge University in couple of weeks, which will be really cool.
And are these opportunities that are just appearing now?
Yeah, kind of. I mean,
for you or you?
No, they're just sort of people that have been getting in touch with me. In fact, there's also been a few people in touch with me for next adventures or next things, which really frustratingly, I'm not allowed to talk about until after the 2nd or 3rd of April, and because I don't actually know if it's going to come off or if it's going to be confirmed. I think it will be, and I'm kind of excited about it, but I don't want to get too excited in case it doesn't happen. But it's also really, really cool as an opportunity, because it's a massively environmentally, it's like all about environmental science and coastal waters around Britain, and it's a massive opportunity because it's essentially a world first. And I really want to give you like that. You heard it here first, exclusive. But I can't.
That's fine.
So
it's all right. This will go public. It'll be published in a little bit. So I'll grab that information for the.
The intro. Okay, because it is going to be when you're pretty special, actually. And So yeah, and it's working really partly good. Through Portsmouth University and stuff like that. So it's quite cool.
Ah, cool. If I stop the recording or the stream, can you tell me? That's all right. I don't want to put you on that either. In case that goes wrong and it's still rolling, no, I'll find out and put it in the intro. Yeah, that's great. So is it? So it's a little bit of information from you. I want to squeeze a little bit out.
Sorry,
so it's to do a coastal walking. Yeah, sorry. So I'm just going to get a little bit of information out of you. I'm not going to get you to tell me what it is, but so it's to do with coastal walking.
It's to do with coastal waters.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Oh, waters. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Well, that's still very relevant to what you've been doing. Does it involve? Is it active? Is it involved doing
it's,
more?
So it involves a lot more about biodiversity and the environment than and it's stuff that I was kind of building on in my blogs and talking about and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's it's giving me a chance to not just talk about it and inform people, but it's given me a chance to actively make a difference and change essentially how a whole data set for that area of science is captured.
Okay, that's I'm going to interlude that into something else then. So before you did this, you were and you still run a building contracting excuse my terminology, but you and your wife are builders by trade. You run a company, don't you? Do you see yourself going back to that, or is this where you want to go now?
I think at the moment, this is where I am at the moment, and that I will take the opportunities as long as they're aligned with my own views and principles for as long as I can. I want to write the book and get that out. I've had a publisher talking to me recently, and I've just finished. I've done like 7 chapters. And because what I didn't want to do, and I'd agreed this with the publisher, it's not going to be a day-to-day journal of what happened. It's more about things like the Cape Wrath experience, the loneliness side, and the kind of how I became part of the path sort of thing. And it's like I'm trying to think of a word. Haven't really got a title, but I quite liked Afraid Edge, A Journey into Human Kindness. I also might call it just Walking It. I don't know yet. It's a few interesting ideas that are coming out of it, and the publisher agreed, don't write a journal, let's make it more interesting, make it really relevant to you.
Yeah, I think that's way more interesting to not just write a journal and the day-to-day account of it.
So that will happen, and then hopefully it's good enough to be picked up, and I might sell 5 copies or something.
I'm sure you'll sell more than 5 copies. Now I look forward to it coming out. I'll be buying it if it comes out for sure. Like, really, really, yeah. I've seen a few posts about you you writing it as well. I'm just trying to turn my phone so I can read what's on your page. it's coming along. When do you have to finish that?
I've given myself to the end of April to have the first draft done.
Oh, wow. Oh,
it's really strange. I think you've got to be quite disciplined with it. And I sort of committed to doing that. I spend most of my mornings doing that. And if I've got time in the afternoon where I've got nothing else on, then I try and do that as well.
Yeah. Okay. Now, another question for you. So imagine if somebody's listening to this and they say to you, well, Chris, like, it's easy for you to, you know, just go and do this walk. You've got, you know, a company that you allows you to go and do it, and you know your life's just sort of set out. So you know, the stars aligned. You can, and it was easy. You know, it's so easy for you to go and do this. What do you say to that? Because it's very, it's not something that doesn't come without a significant amount of commitment. What would you say to somebody who might be quite critical about the fact that you've done this and just able to do that? What did you have to sacrifice, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, well, I think the perception is different to the reality is what I would always say. So I own a company. I set the company up, and I worked very hard at it for the majority of my life to get to a point where I could step away from it a little bit. I didn't take a salary the whole time I was walking. So I sacrificed 2 years or more of salary, effectively. But I knew that my home and my wife and children would be okay because my wife works in the company too. But effectively, as a family, we've lost a significant chunk of money because of that. I also had to be able to trust the people that worked for us, and they had to be behind me 100%, because if they weren't, I couldn't have done that. On top of that, it's put not just financial strain on us as a family, but it's put emotional strain on us and our relationships. You know, there's a period of nearly just over 6 months where I hadn't seen my wife and children at all. And that was the longest period. It's the longest period I've not been around my wife for since we met, you know, and I certainly have never spent that much time away from my children. I have lost friends because of what I've done, because they don't agree with what I've done and how I've done it and things like that. But, you know, if you listen to all the negatives and always do what you're expected to do, then you'd never get anywhere in life and achieve the things you really feel mean something of value to you. So I think having it all set out in life and being able to do it is just one part of it. I think the reality is you have to commit to whatever you want to achieve, whether you've got a company or not. I could have come back and lost everything. I'm lucky that my wife was running the company and she'd been able to keep a good handle on it. But I could have come back to being bankrupt. I could have come back to find that we'd lost our home. I could have come back to all of that stuff. And that stuff, all those thoughts, they happen. Doesn't matter how much you trust someone or love someone. They happen inside your head all the time. And you think that weight is on you because you put your family in this position. You decided to do this. So it's not just committing to it in the beginning. It's staying committed to it and seeing it through. And that's not always easy.
Good answer. Good answer. And shout out to your wife, the unsung hero.
Yeah, here, she's the star. You know,
yeah, like how's she doing?
Well, she wanted to go out, funny enough. But no. I think she wants rid of me. Sorry. Already, but no.
All right. Yeah, oh, wait, yeah, she wants to go out on her own tonight. Yeah. Right? Oh, okay, right. I've not interrupted dating.
No, okay. I think we cool. both love being back around each other. I think, you know, I'm trying to do as much as I can to help out and do things around here and whatever makes her life easier at the moment. But I think deep down she knows that this won't be the last thing or mad, stupid thing that I do anyway. But she's always been my biggest fan and supporter, really. And I don't know where I'd be or what I'd be doing without her. So
brilliant. Well, we'll finish on that, I think, unless you have anything to add. One more question, if I may. So obviously there's a secret thing happening that may or may not happen that you can't tell me about. That aside, give me an inkling of what has come into your mind as to what you'd want to do next.
I definitely want to do some more walking, and I definitely want to do more coastlines. Specifically, I would like to do Ireland, and maybe go and see Owen. I'd quite like to do Jersey and Guernsey with my children and do it the way I did this coastline. So just walk with a tent with them and kind of open them up to that kind of life. To sort of inspire them to be a bit adventurous and love the outdoors. I mean, they do everything outdoors with me anyway, but I mean, if I can affect them the way the path has affected me, that can only be a benefit and a positive thing, I think.
I strongly believe in doing that with your kids as a gift.
Yeah.
I think that it's a generational pass on of outdoors. Of appreciation of outdoors, and that may get lost with a lot of kids in teenage years when, you know, the dynamics of high school, friends, computer games, phones come into it. But I believe strongly that that'll always come back for kids, and if you do that with them, it'll leave them for the rest of their lives. So I think I fully agree with that.
Absolutely. There are lots of coastlines, and as much as I love mountains and I love all sorts of other things and woodlands and all that, the sea is kind of where it's at for me, and you know, it doesn't have to be in this country, but there are lots of coastlines that I'm keen to get out and look at and maybe walk. But now I feel like I'm going to have to go to every bit of the coastline if I go somewhere. It's not just going to be a visit to the seaside, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And then, of course.
Yeah. So, Chris the Coast Walker lives
definitely.
On, really.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely scope for a few islands. And then, of course, I've got to come to Lincoln and meet you somewhere in Lincolnshire.
I'm actually not in Chile. Lincolnshire is my closest coastline. But I'll talk to you about that another time. But no, we need to meet up because that'd be really nice.
Yeah, and you mentioned about organising a trip like to Dovedale or somewhere like that.
I did, yeah. I'd still like to do that, but it might be more autumn now at this point for me. So because I've got
that probably works better for me though. To be honest,
really want that.
Yeah,
does it? Okay. I also think, and also the weather's a bit nicer. I think I don't do heat. I would struggle with, that period of the year, I like walking. It's nice to get out, but I really struggle with
long days on the hill. It's actually perfect because you've got
Oh, it's great. Stunning. Yeah. Absolutely spot on. And actually, I really like walking in winter, but when it gets to sort of 30 degrees in the heat, I'm done. I don't do that. Yeah. Well, that's just me. Anyway, I'm going to stop the recording there. So thank you for joining
me
today.
Thank you for having
me. It's been a pleasure. And I'm not going to do the where can people follow you because I know that you're pretty well known. But it's been lovely to have you.
Thank you, Matthew. Show today.
Episode done. What did you think to that episode of the Distance Hiker podcast with Chris Howard? Chris the Coast Walker was awesome to have on the show. I hope you agree. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you got tons of value out of it or feel inspired and fired up to do something that makes you feel excited and take action on it and get walking, get moving and doing things that just make you feel good. That's what Chris does, and that's why we love him. He's just not afraid to do something for himself, not afraid to just be a little bit selfish in life and take the time to do things that make him happy. Because if he's happy, everybody around him is happy, and I think that's so true with most people, so me included. Moving on. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining me today. Hopefully have you on again soon. I'm sure that you will be putting your boots on again after your rowing challenge. So just to mention as well, which I didn't mention on the intro, Chris was going to reveal to me on the show what he was going to do, but I really didn't know when it was going to be published, so we just kept it quiet at the time. But Chris is doing a rowing event around the length of the UK, so this time he's going to be seeing the landscape by sea, which is just going to be super exciting to watch him do that, as it's been really interesting to watch him do the walk. So I cannot wait to see Chris on his latest event coming up, hopefully in the next couple of months. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please, like and subscribe. You know the drill, Apple, Spotify, you can like and subscribe to it there. The show's now on YouTube, so if you like the YouTube version, just give us a thumbs up, stick something in the comments, say hello, I'll always reply, and you can subscribe, obviously, to the YouTube channel if you want to see more episodes of the Distance Hiker podcast in a video format. But that is it for now. Thank you so much for listening to the show. I cannot wait to share next week's guest with you, who is Chase Tucker, who runs Basecamp Fitness. Until then, thank you so much for listening and see you on the other side.